Today is Monday, December 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the White House says it will not participate in this week's impeachment hearing, although some Republican lawmakers say it should.
I think it would be in his advantage to have them testify, but again, that would shatter the doctrine of executive privilege, and that's the question that he has to weigh in whether to invoke that privilege.
Plus, the impact of the latest stabbing attack in London on Britain's upcoming election, and how the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is addressing AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. Those stories and more are all coming up next. The White House says it will not participate in Wednesday's impeachment hearing by the House Judiciary Committee. Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler invited U.S. President Donald Trump and his counsel to attend the committee's first hearing as the impeachment inquiry moves into its next phase. The House impeachment report on President Donald Trump will be unveiled today behind closed doors for key lawmakers as Democrats push ahead with their inquiry. Now for more, I'm joined in the studio by White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here, Steve.
So the White House has often said that the process has been unfair. There's been no due process afforded to the president. Now that the White House has been invited to the hearings, why are they not attending?
Well, Trump was asked about that on the White House South Lawn just a couple hours ago before he got on the Marine One helicopter. And his short and very predictable answer was because the whole thing is a hoax. He also said it was an absolute disgrace what the Democrats are doing to the country. And he came up with a revised version of the no quid pro quo comment today, because he was asked about the comments that Ukrainian President Zelensky made this weekend in a group magazine interview. And he said, look at that interview, and it very clearly vindicates him that he put words in the Ukrainians' president mouth,
right,
so to speak, saying President Trump did absolutely nothing wrong, and that should end everything. But what Zelensky actually said in the interview is, while saying that there was no quid pro quo, that there really was no excuse for a strategic partner of the United States withholding military aid at a time that Ukraine is at war with Russia.
So the White House counsel says it's not participating in Wednesday's hearing. There is a Friday deadline to even participate in all the other hearings. We do have the vote coming up on this initial hearing coming up. Has there been any indication as to what the White House strategy will be during this next phase?
Well, what Pat Cipollone said in his letter to the Judiciary Judiciary Committee Chairman late yesterday is he'll reply by the end of the week about whether the White House would appear at any future hearings. But definitely, they're not going to be there this Wednesday.
But any strategy, inclination of what they plan to do moving forward, is it just going to be left up to Republican minority members to answer the question?
At this point, that's what it appears. They're, of course, claiming that this is a rigged process. It's unfair. They don't get the number of witnesses and lawyers that the Democrats have. I don't foresee much sort of backroom negotiations for a compromise on this between the Democrats and Republicans, however.
As always, Steve, thank you for stopping by. Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The government says at least 14 people were shot dead in an attack on a church in eastern Burkina Faso on Sunday morning. The identity of the gunman was not immediately clear, and further details on the attack have yet to emerge. Burkinabe forces are caring for the wounded and searching the area. This year, an Islamist insurgency has ignited ethnic and religious tensions in Burkina Faso, rendering large parts of the country ungovernable, especially in northern areas bordering restive Mali. Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, engulfed in crisis over the probe into a murdered journalist, announced on Sunday he planned to step down, saying he would ask his ruling Labour Party to start choosing a new leader for the country next month. calls for Musk to quit had intensified after the investigation into the 2017 car bomb killing of anti-corruption journalists Daphne Caruana Galizia led to charges on Saturday against a prominent businessman with alleged ties to government ministers and senior officials. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged countries Monday not to give up in their fight against climate change as representatives from nearly 200 countries gathered in Madrid for a two-week meeting on tackling global warming. In his opening speech to delegates, Guterres cited recent scientific data showing that levels of heat-trapping gases have hit a record high, reaching levels not seen for at least 3 million years when sea levels were 10 to 20 meters higher than they are today. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday he would strengthen prison sentences, vowing to boost security after an attack in London by a man jailed for terrorism who had been released early. The pledge comes as Britain prepares for a general election December 12th and hosts the annual NATO leaders meeting this week. Reporter Henry Widgewell in London joins us now. Henry, what can you tell us about what Prime Minister Johnson has said about, you know, strengthening the prison sentences related to terror attacks given this last weekend's events?
His line since that attack on Friday is that there are too many prisoners and too many terror suspects in particular being released automatically. And the debate around this attack has been politicized very, very quickly to the dismay, I have to say, of the families of the victims. Boris Johnson is saying that under legislation that he says was introduced under previous governments before the Conservative government came in 2010, it means that some serious criminals are released early. So, for example, in the case of the attacker on Friday, Usman Khan, he was sentenced to 16 years in jail for his part in a plot to attack the London Stock Exchange in 2012, but he was released a year ago under license, which means that he was released from jail, but that he would be monitored by the police and by the security services. There were certain conditions of his release, people he wasn't allowed to be in contact with, places he wasn't allowed to go. But it seems despite the fact that he was being monitored, he was still able to carry out this attack.
You mentioned that this has been politicized. We are, of course, a little over a week away from the general election. What's been the reaction to those discussions across Britain ahead of that vote?
Well, I think there will be many people who will say that this has happened too quickly. Perhaps it is inevitable in an election season so close to the December the 12th polling date that politicians will jump on this and will look at the policies that may have led to this. But I think the reaction of many people in the country that I've spoken to, many newspapers and commentators and so on, has been one that is critical of the politicians for doing this far too early.
Switching gears, U.S. President Donald Trump is now on his way to London for the NATO leaders meeting. What can you tell us about what we can expect to see as these leaders for NATO gather in London?
There are two key themes, I think, underpinning this this meeting, and NATO is keen to say this is not a summit. I think they're downplaying it because of the tensions that are underlying it. The first one has been in existence for a long time, and of course it's something that President Trump has made a particular case of, and that's military spending among the United States' European allies. The second tension underlying this conference is over the war in Syria, and of course the United States pullout in October allowed Turkish forces to move in. There were nearly confrontations between Turkish and United States forces, and Turkish forces are now firing upon the Kurdish allies who helped the Western coalition defeat the Islamic State.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Steve.
An airstrike on a market in a rebel-held town in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib Monday killed at least 10 civilians and wounded others. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the airstrike comes amid an increase of violence in Idlib province, the country's last opposition stronghold. Fighting between troops and insurgents there killed dozens of gunmen on both sides over the weekend. Syrian troops launched a four-month offensive earlier this year against Idlib, which is dominated by al-Qaeda-linked militants. The Syrian government offensive forced hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee their homes, and a fragile ceasefire halted the advance at the end of August, but in recent weeks it has been repeatedly violated. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences are reporting that they have discovered a giant stellar black hole in our Milky Way galaxy. The discovery came as a big surprise to the Chinese astronomers. Lead astronomer Liu Jifeng says that according to most current models of stellar evolution, black holes of such mass should not even exist in our galaxy. The huge stellar black hole has been named LB1. It has a mass 70 times greater than the Sun and is located 15,000 light-years from Earth. Scientists currently list four types of black holes: stellar, intermediate, supermassive, and miniature. Stellar black holes are formed by the gravitational collapse of a star. And until this discovery, stellar black holes had a mass of no more than 20 times that of the Sun. The discovery was reported in the journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong's embattled police force defended their use of tear gas Monday after another weekend of protests and several small-scale clashes.
The truth is that although the organizer got a letter of no objection, a large number of protesters deviated from the approved route of procession. They proceed to Hong Kong bypass, where they throw bricks and glass bottles onto the officers under the bridge. As our warnings are all ignored, our officer had no choice but to use tear gas for dispersal.
Police say 58 people were arrested over the weekend, bringing the total number of arrests since early June to 5,947. Now, for more on the latest protests, I spoke with reporter Justin Solomon in Hong Kong. Justin, what are people saying now that protests have resumed? The police have used tear gas after a relative period of calmness. What has it been like in Hong Kong?
You know, the last 2 weeks have been, as you say, relatively calm. And people in Hong Kong have started to enjoy that return to normalcy once again. And I think they were hoping that would continue for a little bit longer. When the protests kicked off again this past weekend, there was disappointment. It was definitely a sign to the people of Hong Kong that these protests aren't going away. And despite the election results, which went in the favor of the protesters.
Before we get to the election results and yes, the reaction to that, I wanted to ask you about that statement you made about people, you know, enjoying the respite per se, because the economic impact of these protests has been felt with a significant drop in the retail sales. How are people dealing with that part of the ramifications of these 6 months of protests?
It's hurting. It's hurting small businesses. It's hurting large businesses. As you say, the retail number that came out today shows that a drop of nearly 24% in October from the same time last year. That is a huge drop. The government's saying it could be nearly 2% of the GDP in economic losses. People of Hong Kong feel it. The malls are quiet. The streets are quiet.
Going back to the elections, the pro-democracy candidates overwhelmingly won that election. How are people reacting to that?
Well, people were very excited for, one, the massive turnout of voters that came out. That in itself was a victory for democracy, right? That you have all of these people that say we can make our voices heard by voting. After a few hours of the celebration, it was back to reality, which was, we know that we, being the protesters, know that this is only one step, and China is just inches away from Hong Kong, and it's going to be really difficult for them to accomplish anything, even by making their voices heard in the election.
Justin Solomon is a reporter based out of Hong Kong. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, China said on Monday it will suspend U.S. military ship and aircraft visits to Hong Kong and sanction several American pro-democracy and human rights groups in retaliation for the passage of new U.S. legislation supporting anti-government protests in a semi-autonomous territory. North Korea state media on Saturday lashed out at Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe as an imbecile and political dwarf for calling Pyongyang's latest test of a large multiple rocket launcher a ballistic missile launch, and warned that he may see a real one in the near future. As the end of the year deadline North Korea gave the United States approaches, we're joined on the phone now by North Korea fellow John Grover from the Center for the National Interest. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me again.
So John, I wanted to ask you this. As we approach the end of the year, North Korea has steadily increased its tests, its rhetoric. What do you foresee taking place as the month of December ticks on?
Well, I certainly expect to see more last-minute scrambles to have some kind of talks or discussions. There's been rumors for a while now about yet another summit between Kim and President Trump. That remains to be seen if that's enough to stop tensions from rising next year. As you mentioned, Kim does have that end-of-year deadline, and he's also demanding that we end all hostile policy towards North Korea. But that's a very big ask, and it's also kind of vague. That would include sanctions relief and other things, and Kim is acting out. He's doing his tests. We should expect to see more tests. Nothing that's super, you know, like a threat, but more just a way to, you know, saber rattle, to really get people to think, oh, we better get back to the table.
With Trump's focus on the impeachment inquiry domestically, do you foresee perhaps more saber rattling, as you put it, more missile tests, perhaps even a ballistic missile test before the end of year to try to redirect the president's attention back to the Korean Peninsula?
I think we can't rule it out. I think that Kim definitely wants to make sure that people are paying attention to him, even as you mentioned, as Trump is distracted with the impeachment inquiry. And there's a lot of other things, too. So he could test before the end of the year. He could also do it during South Korea's April 2020 elections. He could do it during the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. I could certainly see that happening. The question is how it's framed. If he does a ballistic missile test but tries to write it off as, oh, it's a satellite launch, then maybe that would give some kind of way out to where Trump might not respond as forcefully if, say, it was a nuclear test. Then he would, absolutely, the United States would try to return to maximum pressure.
Really quickly, in about 20 seconds or so we have left, what do you foresee the Moon Jae-in administration doing as the end of the year coming out, since his policy was really to try to engage North Korea?
They'll do everything they can before that end-of-year deadline to get both sides back to that negotiating table and at least kick that can down the road so that we don't see a return to fire and fury.
John Grover is a North Korea fellow over at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
December 1st was World AIDS Day, and according to the United States Centers for Disease Control, approximately 37 million individuals around the world live with HIV, with more than two-thirds of them living in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, for more than three decades, the CDC has been a leader in global HIV research and response. As an agency implementing the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the CDC works with ministries of health overseas, adding its expertise to help deliver sustainable prevention methods and treatment to millions of people in countries most affected by HIV. Dee Mpafi works as a peer counselor in Lesotho, Africa, for the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatrics AIDS Foundation, and Dr. Minesh Shah is an internal medicine physician and a medical officer in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Division of Global HIV and Tuberculosis, HIV Care and Treatment Branch. Dee, I want to begin with you. You have HIV, and you were diagnosed with it at the age of 18. And for many people, no matter how old they are, getting such a diagnosis is incredibly tough to take. And for our listeners, I wanted you to really briefly walk us through what your reaction was so many years ago.
It was really shocking for me. needless that I was working with people, testing them for HIV and trying to encourage them to take their medication. But it really got shocking as I was HIV negative 3 months ago when I got tested. And then after these 3 months, I'm now positive, and I'm like, okay, how did I get this HIV? Where is it coming from? I mean, my boyfriend is HIV negative. My parents are HIV negative. So it was really shocking for me. And it really took me time to say, okay, fine, I'm HIV positive, and I'll take my treatment.
Dr. Shaw, you know, Dee just mentioned, you know, she took a test. She was HIV negative, and all of a sudden she tested positive. What kind of challenges does the CDC face going into not only African areas, but also across the world where people are taking tests and all of a sudden they come back with a positive result?
Thanks, Steve. So as you mentioned, CDC works through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, to provide HIV services in many countries, and especially in sub-Saharan Africa. One of the challenges we have related to testing is that there's many people who do not yet know their status, and some of these people are at risk. And even in Dee's case, where maybe they tested recently, the risk profile can change. And we don't always know why and exactly can we pinpoint, how HIV was transmitted, but we do know that if they're tested positive and we get them on treatment right away, that can help prevent transmission going forward. So when we don't have all the answers, we do know that treatment is effective and important for those who do test positive.
Dee, you actually work with young people who in some cases are living with HIV, and there certainly is a stigma today with having the disease and having the virus in you. What kind of things do you do to help eliminate the stigma that these young individuals are facing?
Okay. Basically, we have what we call peer support groups, where we have these young people coming to the facility and gathering together to share their experiences, to share their challenges that they come across as people living with HIV. And it becomes very effective because they get to know who is going through, and they get to talk about it amongst themselves and try to figure out how they need to face the world. So it's pretty a great experience because you find them having to, well, basically, I won't be having to do a lot of work, but they get to communicate with each other and try to figure out how to face the world, what do we need to do, and what steps do we need to take. So basically, we just polish on what they share already. So it's really working, the peer support group. And as well as the media outreaches that we do, we try by all means to go to radio and give them information about HIV, information about any other health-related issues, and try to go wherever they are, like churches and schools, and talk to them and try to give them hope for the future. I try to share my story with them just to make sure that they feel not alone in this, that you might be a health professional, but you can still have HIV. You might be whoever you are, but still have HIV. But still, life goes on, and you'll still succeed.
Dr. Shaw, what are some of the challenges that, outreach programs still face, since this is a global epidemic?
Yeah, I think what Dee is talking about is some of the most important work, and that is reducing the stigma. And the reason, Steve, reducing stigma is so important is because actually from a science and technical point of view, this is a very optimistic time for HIV treatment. The treatment we have today is better, more effective, better tolerated than any treatment we've had in the past. And not only that, we know that if we can find people early in their illness and put them on treatment and maintain them on treatment, they can live a normal, healthy life with a life expectancy as long as those who are HIV negative. So in many ways, the science is right there for us to end the epidemic, and we need to work on some of these other challenges, such as stigma, to get people to access these services that can really help them. And that's where Dee's work is so important.
And that was the CDC's Dr. Manish Shah and CDC Global HIV Beneficiary Dee Mpafa. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.